Listen to the best of the church's music for the Epiphany season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's conventional wisdom that capitalism is good for just about everything. It waters all the plants, everything grows. Question is it good for the family? At its most basic level, is a central interest of capitalism a strong or a weak family? How has it proven itself over history? You're going to be answering that question. Dr. Alan Carlson joins us on this Monday afternoon. He's a regular guest, former president of the Rockford Institute and Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society, author of a forthcoming column for Chronicles, a magazine of American culture titled A City on a Hill with Transgender Toilets. Dr. Carlson, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Happy to be with you again.
You say that capitalism, its most basic level, has a vested interest in family weakness. What do you mean by that?
Well, let's face it, strong, autonomous families that are rich in functions, that produce a lot of their own goods, have a garden, have a homeschool their children, they make for very poor consumers of capitalism's goods. Capitalism grows, and this has been true since it emerged 200 years ago. It grows as it takes over the tasks formerly done by families or by small communities, local communities, and turns them into industrial processes. It began with weaving yarn and making cloth, but today it's completed the transition. Even infant care is turned over to capitalism. That's what we call kinder care. Our meals, family meals, are turned over to the fast food industry increasingly, and everything in between has been turned over, leaving the family effectively functionless and economically dependent on outside sources. A very dramatic example of this is divorce. A strong, autonomous family built on a good, strong marriage does a lot of its own things. A divorce, though, creates a dramatic set of improvements for capitalism. Two households instead of one. You have to have two refrigerators instead of one. Two houses, or at least two forms of shelter. Two of everything where one before had sufficed. Those are just some examples of at least at the basic level of incentives. Capitalism is not the friend of the family.
Now, is this, with about a minute here, is this a design of capitalism or just simply an accident of capitalism?
Well, at some level, it is a design. That at the most basic level, it tries to take functions out of the family. It defunctionalizes the home. Now, that's got its good side, its bright side. It's cheaper to buy cloth that's been made in a factory than to make your own, on the one hand. On the other hand, as the Amish have understood, the more you can do for yourself, the more you can make for yourself, the more you can grow for yourself, the stronger your family will be. And that's still true today in many fundamental ways.
Some people kind of picture the top-hatted capitalist there as the ultimate villain with about 30 seconds. Are you saying that there are other, like socialism or something like that, are somehow better for the family?
Well, there's two different kinds of capitalism. Let me get into that very quickly. There's family-centered capitalism, which is the family-centered business. It's the small business. It's the local home, family-owned and controlled business. Those families tend to be, and those businesses tend to be much more family-centric, respect the family lives of their workers much better, are tied to communities. It's the publicly held companies, the really big guys, the ones that are trading on Wall Street. They don't care a hoot about family life.
Dr. Alan Carlson is our guest. We're going to talk about capitalism, the family, more on the other side of the break. We need to talk about the strange bedfellows, not only politically, but economically, and in some ways philosophically, that has been made between social conservatives who, well, of all the things they do want, one of the highest priorities that they have is a strong and enduring family and capitalism. We'll talk about that on the other side of the break. Feel free to join us with questions or comments, 1-877 623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, or a tweet at issuesetc. After our conversation with Dr. Alan Carlson, we want your answer to the question, should the Johnson Amendment, that amendment that since 1954 has effectively prohibited nonprofit organizations, including Christian congregations, from engaging in politics from the pulpit, should it be repealed? President Trump has said it should be. Do you agree or disagree? We'll talk about that during Audio Open Lines after our conversation with Dr. Alan Carlson on capitalism and the family. Stay tuned.
Daily exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about capitalism and the family with Dr. Alan Carlson, formerly of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society. He's authoring a forthcoming column for Chronicles, a magazine of American culture titled The City on a Hill with Transgendered Toilets. Dr. Carlson, you tell a sad story about having to spend a couple of days sick in bed with nothing better to do than to watch old movies, wherein two movies that you watched you found instructive, maybe not entertaining, but instructive in this regard of capitalism and the family. What did you experience there?
Well, in some ways it runs even deeper into that. It was, what is the nature of the human species and the human being? The first movie I saw, this was over 30 years ago, was a film called Quest for Fire. It's about a group of what we would normally call cavemen, but early hominids, human beings, struggling to survive in a hostile environment and usually losing, not doing very well. What made it possible for them to survive? Well, according to the film, it was when a woman enters the tribe, a woman wandering from another group, who knows two amazing things. One, she knows about permanent pair bonding between a man and a female, a man and a woman, and particularly how that relates both socially and sexually. And she teaches that to one of the men of the tribe, and suddenly he becomes a father. Before, he was just another random male, randomly interacting with other women. He becomes a father, and he bonds with her. He's going to stick with her. The other amazing thing she knows is how to make fire out of using sticks and animal dung and so on. These two things transform the human species. Now, for Christians, this story doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but for science, what it does, at least what it says, is that science does agree with Christianity on this, is that the basic, and this was confirmed, the film was confirmed later by articles in Science magazine by leading paleoanthropologists, that the big key leap for human beings is when a monogamous, permanent, procreative pair bonding between men and women took place. Translated into English, that means when we discovered marriage and we discovered social fatherhood, when men bonded to the woman who bore their child and stuck with them, became a provider and a protector. And she became a nurturer of children. That was the great leap forward in human evolution. And that's not a whole lot different from what Genesis 1 and 2 teach. The second film I saw was the opposite of this. It was called Victor Victoria, a film, 1981, based on the story of a woman who's pretending to be a man who's pretending to be a woman. This is set in the 1930s, specifically in Chicago and Paris, although it's got echoes from the original film made in Germany in 1933. And it's a story of decadence. It's a story of the collapse of the Christian sexual ethic, a turn towards homosexuality, bisexuality, everything else that goes along with that, a rejection of the understanding of the human being as being conjugal by nature. That is, you're not a complete and fulfilled as a human being until you're married and bear children. It's a rejection of that completely, a move towards, well, the contemporary ethic of transgenderism and the LGBT2 agenda. Watching the two together, it seemed to me it was like watching the whole pageant of human history condensed into 4 hours. The rise of the human species as we became conjugal and aware of how important that was, how important marriage and family was, central to our survival, and then the collapse of that ethic in the 20th and early 21st century.
If you would tell us about what's really kind of the all politics makes for strange fellows, bedfellows, but strange ones between two groups that are usually considered in the popular mind to be a kind of have not competing interests, but in fact overlapping interests, that of social conservatives and capitalism.
Well, originally, the social conservative movement, let me define that very briefly, that's being pro-life, as you oppose abortion, skeptical, if not opposed to birth control. It means being in favor of the family and of small, strong, autonomous families, closely held family property, small-scale property, defense of religious liberty, defense of strong churches. The original party behind that was not the Republican Party, it was the Democrats. We go back, actually, to the 1890s, the emergence of William Jennings Bryan as the leading figure in the Democratic Party of the time, presidential candidate three times, 1896, 1900, 1908. Perhaps the most profoundly Christian politician in American history. He favored all of the things I just described. He was a strong proponent of family life, of defense of property, of defense of the sacred public square. And that was the Democratic Party. It was the party of the Southern evangelicals. It was the party of the Roman Catholic Church at that time. It was the party of the maternalist movement, which was women, when they were strong, getting first engaged in politics, what did they want to do? They wanted to protect marriage and family, and especially the interests of children. Doing that by opposing the incentives of capitalism to draw mothers into the workforce, for example, supporting the mother at home, supporting large families. That was the Democratic Party. Who were in the Republican Party? Well, it was the interest of large business, of the major manufacturers. Small businessmen tended to be Democrats. And it was also the feminist movement as it emerged in the 19-teens and the 1920s. Strongly pushing for the Equal Rights Amendment, which was drafted by Republicans in the mid-1920s, strongly pushing for birth control. It was a Republican woman who first signed on with Margaret Sanger's campaign for legalizing birth control nationwide in the 1920s and 1930s. So the Republican Party, from the 1920s at least, until and even earlier, up until about 1970, was the party of Planned Parenthood and feminism.
What happened?
The 60s and 70s happened, and it's a revolution that still hasn't been well, I think, explained and documented. The defining book on it still needs to be written. But the Democrats, who were still, as late as the mid-1960s, the party opposing abortion, the party opposing birth control, the party opposing feminism, the party favoring family wages for men, mothers at home, over the next 15 years, that party abandoned all of those principles, drove out of the party those politicians who favored social conservatism. The last ones to leave tended to be Northeastern Catholics, and embraced the sexual revolution, embraced hardcore feminism. Meanwhile, the Republican Party wound up sort of as the shelter for fleeing Democrats. These were the Reagan Democrats, Phyllis Schlafly, Jerry Falwell, Paul Weyrich. Figures like that led abandoned Democrats into the Republican Party, where they found a very, I guess you'd say, uneasy and not exactly friendly welcome.
Is that the divide between what usually, this has come out every political campaign over the last 50 years, the divide between the so-called country club Republicans and social conservatives?
That's a good way to summarize it, and it's a very real divide. I mean, one place you see it most directly is in an area where the agendas collide, which is the otherwise dry area of tax policy. Social conservatives favor tax relief for families with children. Strongly in favor of a generous personal exemption, strongly in favor of the child tax credit, which gives extra tax relief to eligible families raising young children. It's a great benefit. Who's the greatest opponent of the child tax credit? The Wall Street Journal. Wall Street businessmen. The Journal, almost every it seems like three or four times a year, and I think that's an accurate read in recent years, runs main editorials denouncing the child tax credit as the worst idea ever, while seeking every possible means of cutting taxes on corporations. In fact, the Wall Street Journal position is corporations should pay no income tax, but families should pay more income tax. In fact, the more children they have, the more they should pay. That's the Wall Street position. And again, it fits logically with the what I'll call the orientation of raw capitalism, untamed and uncontrolled by other impulses, such as religion.
You say that it's time for social conservatives, here are your words, to climb down from the attic, assert their numbers, and politely but firmly show the Wall Streeters the back door of the tent. What do you envision there?
Well, I hope it happens. It hasn't happened yet under the Trump administration. He's pretty much relied, I think, too heavily on Wall Street for his appointments so far. But they should be thrown out. I mean, they should be, well, Trump, politely invited out. We'll do it the Christian way. They'd be much happier in the party of Hillary Clinton. They'd be much happier in the party of the radical the noises coming out of Silicon Valley. The major companies like Facebook and Google are led by leaders are strongly anti-family, strongly anti-Christian social ethics, strongly in favor of the LGBTQ agenda, strongly in favor of gay marriage, strongly in favor of free access to abortion, and so on. They're there now. And again, my argument is that that's not an anomaly. That makes sense. The party of creative destruction, which is one way of looking at raw capitalism, is nicely aligned with people who also favor moral and social destruction. That's the kind of chaos they like.
Some thinking politically would say, but then that means all the Wall Street money would go toward those terrible goals. Is it already going towards those terrible goals?
I think most of it is. And again, let me defend my kind of free market company that I think are still on the good side of the good guys. That's the small, tend to be smaller, but not always smaller. I'm thinking of Hobby Lobby. It's a big national corporation. But these are companies that are family held, privately held. They're not subject to the same pressures that the Wall Street companies are. They're the glory of what I'll call the free market. These are companies where the people that run them are tied to their local communities. They take personal responsibility for their workers. They don't fire them at a fleet. They don't move to Mexico the first time that becomes a nice advantage. They're the good guys. Those companies, I'm in fact not only would defend, but I'm in favor of them. They're the glory of a free market system, of a free enterprise system. The companies that are the trouble are the problem are the publicly held ones. And I say just let them go. They're already mostly sending their money, corporate money, to the Democratic Party and to in support of radical causes. And they might as well just complete the journey and let the Republican Party become a true pro-family, pro-life populist party.
Doug writes this, I believe that your guest is conflating capitalism, a.k.a. free markets, with the industrial age and contemporary culture. I appreciate the evidence your guest put forth supporting why free markets would be opposed to family. However, he fails to identify the reasons free markets need family. Free markets need consumers. As far as I know, the family is the best way to create consumers. What are your thoughts there, Dr. Carlson?
Well, on the one hand, I used to believe that, and I spent about four decades trying to preach that to Fortune 500 companies and got nowhere. They just don't care. They literally don't care. And again, those are the companies I'm criticizing, the great big ones, the publicly held great big companies that trade on Wall Street. They don't care. That maybe not have been true 100 years ago. There were some that did, but not now. They're completely gone. On the other hand, it's true. If a thoughtful corporate leader would say, well, we need future consumers, we need children. But that's not really how the system works, particularly when if you're running a publicly held company, your time perspective is not 50 years or two generations or five generations ahead, but it's only the next year or two, to the next corporate board meeting. You just got to increase your market return. So what do you do? Well, if it's cheaper to build a product in Vietnam than it is in St. Louis, send it over to Vietnam. What happens to the people in St. Louis? Not my problem. They just don't care. They can always find another place somewhere else that will both make the product cheaper and also for a while, the Vietnamese will buy the products for a while. The Chinese are becoming consumers now, and the Chinese will buy the products. And if what happens to these old markets in America, well, it's not really my problem. In the long run, I'm not around. In the short run, I can make more money this way. That's, I think, how the mindset actually works.
What is familism?
Familism, it's actually a phrase used by one of my favorite writers. He's actually a son of Missouri, Carl Zimmerman. He's a sociologist. He taught at University of Minnesota. Then for decades, he was one of the primary sociologists at Harvard University. And for him, familism was this commitment to procreative families, to families that are functioning based on marriage, and a commitment to having children. And in his view, the responsible large family was the key, is what a society wanted, the creation of responsibly created large families based on marriage. Familism is an ideology, that a set of ideas, maybe a better way to put it, that supports and confirms that politically, economically, socially, and culturally. A familistic culture is one where, for example, all of the music that's being produced, or at least most of the music, affirms marriage, affirms family love and commitment, affirms parents, affirms the presence of children at home and a joy. That's not the kind of music we get today, so we're certainly an anti-familistic culture. But if you could imagine possibly the other way, that's what it would be.
Someone finally says, Dr. Carlson, it sounds great, but you're talking about, in essence, reversing the Industrial Revolution, going back to those times, probably better, but much simpler times, and that horse left the barn about 100 years ago.
Actually, that's a great comment. I just think it's not true. Well, it is true, but it's also not true. You're right. I do want to reverse the Industrial Revolution, at least in part. And I think the thing is, though, that's possible. What do I mean? Start a home school. That's undoing the industrialization of American education. Now, the government got involved in that as well, joyfully joining in. Start a home school. You've reversed the Industrial Revolution within your own home. You've created a small but very important part of a home economy. Start a home garden. Start a small home business. Actually, right now, the tools for reconnecting home and family are stronger than they've ever been. I mean, the Internet has caused a host of problems, ranging from, well, the worst of them being, for example, the flow of pornography into homes. But it's created a host of opportunities. Somebody that's relatively gifted at using the Internet to market a small product can do wonders today, compete effectively against the biggest corporation because of market, the equality that the Internet brings. The home computer. You know, 50 years ago, the only people that could have a computer of any power and size and significance were either huge research facilities or great corporations. The computer would fill a whole building, the early ones, the UNIVACs and so on. Today, my cell phone has more power and more potential economic power and analytical power and marketing power than the equivalent of a $1 billion UNIVAC back in 1955 or 1960. The home computer is an incredibly useful tool for building a business, for finding markets. Recreating the home economy is possible. Now, obviously, I'm not going the whole way back, although some, like I say, I'll use the Old Order Amish, one of the fastest growing ethnic groups in America. What do? They are undoing the Industrial Revolution and succeeding very well, thank you. They make a nice living. They're growing. They have big families. Their community is, in fact, thriving, where other Christian communities who don't do things like that are shriveling and dying away. So, yes, in part, I do want to undo the Industrial Revolution. I think, in fact, it's the Christian way to live.
Dr. Alan Carlson is former president of the Rockford Institute and Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society. He is author of a forthcoming column for Chronicles, a magazine of American culture titled A City on a Hill with Transgender Toilets. You can read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Carlson, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
In 1954, Congress passed an amendment to the U.S. tax code called the Johnson Amendment that, at the time, Texas Senator Johnson was the sponsor for it. What it did was effectively prohibit Christian congregations, Jewish synagogues, any houses of worship, and all nonprofits of that category from participating in or in any way influencing political campaigns one way or the other, in favor of a candidate for electoral office or against a candidate for electoral office. It's not been enforced very strongly, and it's been flouted by many on both left and right. President Trump says he wants to destroy the Johnson Amendment, have it repealed by Congress. That certainly could happen. What are your thoughts on it? Should the Johnson Amendment be repealed? If so, why? If not, why not? Would it help or hurt Christian congregations? I want your answers to those questions during Open Lines on the other side of the break. 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Stay tuned. Open Lines is next.
Oh, morning star, oh, morning star, shine with the world's light across the light.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the Epiphany season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
When a Christian woman is critical of her own flesh, she holds her Creator in contempt.
Rose Adel from her new book, Ladylike, Living Biblically.
Our Heavenly Father knit us together in the womb. He did not do a bad job. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. Psalm 139:14. That goes for everyone, including the one who thinks she's the ugliest of them all.
You can purchase and download Concordia Publishing House's new audiobook, Ladylike, Living Biblically, at Amazon, Audible, and iTunes.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Tired of hearing about what you have to do for God? Then come hear what He has done for you. Receive His gifts of life and salvation through the cross of Jesus Christ. If you think big screens belong in movie theaters, then you'll be right at home at Faith Lutheran Church in Beaufort, South Carolina. God's powerful saving word needs no gimmicks, so we simply teach the word of God and administer His sacraments. We plant and water while God gives the growth. Faith Lutheran Church of Beaufort, South Carolina, where the Bible is still the Word of God and where we still speak the historic Christian liturgy. This is your grandfather's church. Come home.
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. Working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry, lcms.org/deaconess.